Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
So I watched Lockout over the weekend.
Yeah, good movie.
I thought it was pretty good. On your suggestion. It was Escape from New York in space, as you said.
In space.
Yeah. All right, the obligatory in space. But
it wasn't me this time.
It was a fun movie.
Cool. Can't wait to see it myself. I got Skyrim.
And you're going to play this when?
I've been playing it for about a week now. I've actually been, it's been pretty slow as far as freelance work goes, so.
Sorry, you got what?
Skyrim, the next chapter of the Elder Scrolls Oblivion series.
Online game.
No, it's not online, actually, and that's one of the reasons that I bought it, is because it's there's lots of different quests and things, but it's actual written stories that are good, instead of, go kill 10 boar.
Oh, you don't play it online?
Nope, it's a single player, only on your computer.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's really, really good. Like, if you ever wanted to get into a computer game, this is the one. It's fantastic. It's a lot of different options. It's really beautiful. There's pretty good written stories that you can play through. I really recommend it.
Okay. I watched The Hobbit over the weekend on DVD.
Didn't feel like 3 hours, did it?
No, I enjoyed that. It was good.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good, too.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah,
I mean, except for the glamour shots of Thor and Oakenshield with his hair blowing all the time, but...
Oh, it was gorgeous.
Yeah, the dwarves look like two species. They look like...
The handsome dwarves and the non-handsome
serious
dwarves.
Serious and comedy, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed, not in the movie at all, but I suppose in myself, because they had those kind of big, sweeping, gorgeous shots that they had, like in The Lord of the Rings, these huge scenery shots. And I remember being completely awestruck with them in the Lord of the Rings series. But in The Hobbit, I was kind of already used to it after the three movies. So I wasn't as awestruck by them, and it kind of sucked, you know? I remember thinking during the movie, like, I wish that I hadn't seen Lord of the Rings, because this would be more impressive otherwise.
Well, I guess it's still New Zealand, so, I mean, if you've seen it once. I could have done without the storm giant fight.
Yeah.
But other than that, I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought the casting was good. Was it Martin Freeman is his
yes.
name?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought he played a really good Bilbo.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The casting was good. Yeah.
The riddle scene between him and Gollum was just fantastic. I thought
that was
so
great,
well played.
Great scene.
Yeah. And for that matter, Gollum as well is so good. And not to say that he wasn't in the last movies, but it just continues to be awesome.
Yep, he was good. And
was it? Andy Serkis, is that?
Yeah, it's his name.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we've referenced him enough on the podcast to,
And I like the trolls. That was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I started reading The Hobbit today.
Oh,
or
nice.
Rereading it. I haven't read it, 20 years?
Yeah.
No, longer.
I actually don't like The Hobbit as a book that much. I mean, it's good, but I like The Lord of the Rings better, only because you can kind of tell that The Hobbit it was written more of a children's book, because he kind of breaks the fourth wall a little bit more. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like outside real world references. So, as usual, I'm a glutton for punishment. And I read the recent Legends and Lore article by Mike Merles again. And
it totally changed your mind. You love the game now, right?
Yeah, the exact opposite of that. I'm going to keep it short. Again, disagree with a lot of stuff there. But it did, like, I was talking to Chris about it, you know, via email, and Chris raised a really good question.
Why, thank you. Oh, which was?
Yeah, I was waiting for that, yeah.
Didn't realize that was a cue. I thought it was a pause there.
It didn't sound like a cue to me either.
Sorry.
Oh, no, we were just talking about, like, that, you know, with Wayne being disappointed, with a lot of the people in the comments section being disappointed, we're wondering how big of a hit D&D Next will be. And if it's not, you know, what could happen? Would Hasbro close down the company? Would they keep the name? Would they shelve the name? Would they sell it off? So, yeah, the question was then, just theoretically speaking, if D&D were to go away, if Hasbro, you know, closed the company but kept the name so nobody else could produce it, then what would happen? I mean, that's the primary gateway game. Who do you think could take D&D's place? Or could someone?
Honestly, I don't think anyone would take D&D's place, at least not for a while. I don't think the hobby would disappear. It would take a serious hit, because D&D is so well known and it is the gateway game for better or worse, that's where most people start. Mm-hmm. So if it went away, I don't think there would be a gateway game.
Yeah, I'm trying to think this because there's not really any other contenders that have kind of all the same advantages. I mean, there's like GURPS and Savage Worlds. And Savage Worlds, I reckon, kind of has a shot, but the both of them, they're kind of the general game systems. They don't have a world for somebody who knew getting into the hobby to latch onto.
I wonder how many people have actually like started with Savage Worlds.
Well, the reason I think is because it's a fairly easy system, being in that it's short. It's a short book to read through, and it's also so cheap. So,
right.
I think it's something that maybe it's for casual gamers to try out a secondary game, but it's not such a great gateway game. And then,
I think the generic games are really tough because they don't really ride on anything.
Yeah,
any property's coattails. So like, Dungeons and Dragons rides on the coattails of things like Lord of the Rings and like kind of the fantasy craze that was picking up at that time.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And thank you for putting it better than I could have. And the other one that kind of has like a really wide appeal is World of Darkness, but that's too mature. You know, you don't. It's not kind of the all ages safe that that D&D is. You know.
I think you're kind of selling them. Not short, but I think you're inflating them by saying, you know, as another well-known and popular game. I think it kind of has a...
You don't think so?
Compared to the other ones? Well, I mean, anything compared to D&D is minority, but I don't think World of Darkness has a big a fan base as you kind of said, but...
That's okay, yeah. I don't know. I have a feeling that they're pretty big, especially with all the LARPers around and such. I'd say at least as big as GURPS, so kind of like the second tier. But maybe I'm just saying because they've been around for a long time, and not actually the fan base.
Yeah, like
they're a core modern game.
Yes, yes.
And I think fantasy, just by virtue of the way the genre is structured, is a good gateway genre. Whereas, like, if I said, "Okay, let's play a science fiction game," and then ask you, "Okay, what movie did you just immediately reference or think of?"
Yeah, or maybe. Star Trek.
Okay, well, whoa, there's a rift right there. But if we said, okay, let's play a fantasy game, people are kind of probably going to default to Lord of the Rings or something pretty similar. And even if they default to Conan, Robert E. Howard's Conan, or David Gemmell's Druss, I mean, the tech's all the same, and it's just how much magic is in the world. But there's still a little magic.
Right.
So they would be able to walk in with, you know, I'm going to play... You know, Skilganon from the David Gemmell books, who's just like a master swordsman, and I'm going to be, you know, Conan, who's a master swordsman. And
I'm going to be Merlin, somebody, the magician.
Yeah, and somebody be Merlin, so you got a magician. And yeah. I don't think people read like the Grey Mouser in that anymore, but somebody could conceivably say that.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that's why that it has that advantage. Maybe Pathfinder.
I was thinking Pathfinder too. It doesn't have a huge market share compared to other games, but I mean, I suppose that's because D&D is out there.
Yeah, no, I don't
actually,
know.
It does actually have a pretty big market share now. Its products started to outsell 4th edition.
No kidding.
Now, 4th edition sales were disappointing, and which was why it got the rug pulled out from under it. But, I mean, that's saying something.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that they'd surpassed them.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm really impressed. Well, then, yay, go Pathfinder.
Yeah.
I don't know. Pathfinder may be able to pick up the slack. Like, if D&D did disappear, Pathfinder may be able to fill the role as the gateway game. But I don't know. I kind of get the feeling that there was just too big of a rift created by people who liked 4th edition and people who liked, you know, 3rd edition to kind of scoop up the people who liked 4th edition in that Pathfinder group. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't see that happening where...
Do you think there's room for another company like Paizo to pick up and make a 4th edition clone for all the fans of that?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, people are sure vocal about liking 4th edition, so it seems as if they could, but whether that would be sustainable, I don't know. But yeah. I don't know. I, as I said before, I don't think any of the games, you know, kind of second or third tier games behind D&D currently have the popularity or, you know, whatever else is necessary to take on the role that D&D filled as the primary gateway game.
Yeah, I'm reluctant to agree, but I think you're right. Yeah, it's at least that there's nobody waiting in the wings, but I don't think it would really be that long before something came up and became kind of like the hobby standard.
I don't disagree. Something would eventually fill, you know, the role that, that D&D did. It would just take a while for that to happen, in my opinion.
Part of the problem, though, is that it's a different environment.
I mean,
there's too many other options, both within the hobby and outside of the hobby. So whereas D&D could be a horrendously flawed product, it's in the, you know, one of the reasons why I got into D&D is like you go to, I lived on a Canadian military base, but the Stars and Stripes, which is like an American military bookstore, it was still, it was for whatever reason had a contract with the Canadian military. So they would sell D&D and the Stars and Stripes. So, and they were pretty small bookstores. So, I mean, space was at a premium, but you could get just about any D&D thing there. You couldn't get anything else. So if you wanted to play role-playing games or you wanted to play fantasy role-playing games, that was all there was.
Yeah.
And if you didn't like it, well, too bad.
Right.
Yeah, true.
You know, and that's maybe that's why a lot of the older gamers are all into house ruling. They're just kind of used to it. Now you're just like, oh, I don't really like this, and I kind of want to play, you know, more sword and sorcery. Maybe I'll go play a Song of Ice and Fire role-playing for that, you know. Yeah.
And now there's hundreds of games that you can pick up so easily, PDFs online.
Yeah.
Almost spoiled for choice. But yeah, I totally think you're right, Lyle. I think the newer generations, there's too many other options for the hobby, including things like World of Warcraft and Skyrim, that, there's just not as many people getting into the hobby.
Yeah. I mean, not to belabor, because I think we mentioned this over and over, but I think the big problem, the big hurdle, I'm not really excited about all these modular rules, but I don't want to really get into that.
Mm-hmm.
But the big problem is they haven't hit upon a sustainable economic model, at least for this. And Wayne and I were talking today was like in first edition, kind of their, not their cash cow, but their economic model was on the back of the adventures.
Yeah.
You keep pumping out the adventures, the modules, people
right.
buy those. You had the Greyhawk setting, but that was just about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they introduced stuff through the adventures. Then there's, of course, there's the Fiend Folio and things like that, which, you know, add to the, we'll say, like the splat books. And then in second edition, they kind of wrote the campaign settings, and then just like, let's release an entirely new campaign setting, support that and all the support.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And then third edition was all about, let's add more rules.
Yeah.
And people got really tired of that pretty quick. And I almost thinking is, I wonder if you go back to like, not those systems, first and second edition, but try to think of, like, could you, like, have a real solid set of rules, you know, forget this, like, making it so module that nobody really knows what the core game is.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But have, like, a really solid set of rules and then release all these, using the second edition model, all these different campaign settings and fully support them. And, of course, it splits people because they're going to have preferences, but at least you're kind of capturing as much as you can.
Yeah, but, like, the thing about that, and, again, this kind of makes perfect sense, is, like, they still, even if you have the different settings, and, yeah, people are going to gravitate to the settings that they like, whether it's, like, Dark Sun, Planescape, you know, Mysteria, Greyhawk, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That was all built on the spine of the basic game, you know, like you couldn't play any of those settings without having the basic game first.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't included in the box setting because I got the Planescape box set. My brother got Forgotten Realms, and yeah, you had to have second edition AD&D hardback books to play. You know, the core three. So I don't think that's such a bad model, you know.
But what differentiates it from the third edition is that they were also getting money from the settings.
Oh, exactly. Yeah,
but in third edition, when they had the open license, I'm not saying it was a bad thing for me as a consumer, but I wonder how good that was in the long run for Wizards of the Coast. Because yeah, sure, I bought those core books, but then I didn't really. I mean, they released the Forgotten Realms book was gorgeous. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
But then there's now the shelf space is crowded with all these other settings using the same set of rules.
Right.
And not necessarily from the same company, so.
Yeah. I think that the open license did a lot for them to spread the popularity of the game, but you're right, it probably killed their economic model.
Well, I mean, to answer that question, all you have to do is look at the gaming license that came with 4th edition, which is much more restrictive than the one in 4th 3 was.
Yeah.
There's your answer. And like, why did they do that? Well, because, yeah, it kind of, maybe not killed their business, but yeah, it was initially good, spread word of mouth, you know, you have to have these core three to use these other products. But after a while, you're like, I'm not going to buy anything from WotC because I like this thing now, you know?
Yeah.
So.
I can't think why like that releasing modules and adventures system wouldn't work all that well anymore. But that said, I can't think of any gaming company now that does that system. So I'm wondering, maybe it isn't. Or maybe I just can't think of one.
I don't know. I tend to think adventures are, I'm not going to say a hard sell, but I don't know. I guess technically the only thing you need are the core three, right? Everything else you can build yourself, the setting and the adventures, and you can even house rule stuff. But maybe adventures are one of the more easy items for groups to create themselves. Mm-hmm. So it might be a harder sell, especially since we're not at the beginning of the birth of role-playing games anymore, where right. I could see, like, first edition is like, we don't really know how to play. Give us something we can run through that kind of shows us how to play, how one of these things is constructed. And maybe that's why first edition had that, because, hey, no one else really knew how to run the game, and that's what these adventure modules did. You know, they kind of spelled out what to do, and now most people kind of know what that is, and so could you get away with that? Maybe. I don't know.
I'm going to disagree a little bit, even though I do prefer the campaign setting model. I think and third edition actually released a lot of adventures, which was good when they came out, but the adventures are what tie people together. Because people don't say, hey, do you remember we all played in the Forgotten Realms world? Yeah. No, they say, do you remember we played Tomb of Horrors? Did you play Tomb of Horrors? Yeah. Oh, what did you think of that? You know,
it sucked.
That doorway. wasn't that really unfair? Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that why you play WoW now? Yeah, it is.
But they, I mean, those give people a common vocabulary where it's not as, I mean, it's like being from the same town versus being from the same country.
Okay.
I guess.
Okay.
No, so an adventure is like you're from the same town. You're going to talk about those stories from around the town. But if you're all from like Canada or the States, you'd be like, yep, yeah, I'm from the States too. Cool.
Yeah.
But if you're like Philly, oh yeah, yeah. did you ever go there? Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Did you go there? How about that other place and that third place over there?
Oh yeah, I got shot there.
Yeah.
Clearly, I'm not from Philly. Jackass.
Yeah, I know, which is why I kept bringing it up. Yeah.
Do you ever run up those steps and jump up and down? Yeah.
Yeah. You remember Rocky? Yeah.
Oh God. All right. Stop right now.
Remember Will Smith? Yeah. Remember you had to go to Bel Air? Yeah. That was so
all
sad.
Right. You guys are done. No, I agree with you for the most part. However, I'm thinking of Planescape, and if settings have like a real iconic place, then I think that can do the same thing as the adventures a little bit.
Okay, I never played that.
Although I'm certainly not disagreeing with what you're saying. I'm just saying, you know.
You're right though. I mean, some of those worlds, and Planescape is a great example. That was a work of art. Just the everything put about it.
Yeah, it was just so like weird, and everybody got gathered at that one central hub. You know, kind of at the center of everything. So it was almost kind of like a blend of what Lyle said. It was kind of almost like an adventure that was campaign sized, you know? Mm-hmm.
I think second edition did a good job with that. I mean, there was the Ruins of Undermountain, so that was kind of, again, like you're saying, everybody can remember it as a kind of a campaign setting or an addition to the campaign.
Right, what was
but
that
also
Underdark
as an
campaign.
Adventure itself.
Oh, yeah, or like Ravenloft grew from an adventure into a campaign.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So consensus seems to be, just bringing it back, there would be no gateway?
There wouldn't be one gateway to rule them all. which reminds me, I have my eye on the One Ring RPG.
Okay.
It's gotten some good reviews. And of course, like, yeah, I just watched The Hobbit. You know, I'm that soft. Such a soft touch.
So in other words, all I got to do is rent Dungeons & Dragons 3, Book of Vile Darkness, and you'll be all set on D&D next?
Guess what's in my Discus cube? Dungeons and Dragons 3. Here, this is a hilarious thing. I was looking for Argo in the video store, and in Tataya they often have like the hot, you know, 20 movies rentals.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's Dungeons & Dragons 3, right under Argo in my video store.
Well, no, I think what made it even funnier is practically like the same day, I went to my Tsutaya down here. I saw this thing with a dragon on the cover. I'm like, what is that? And I look and I said, oh my god, that's Dungeons & Dragons 3, and every copy here is rented out. What the hell is going on?
A, really, Japan?
Yeah,
really?
A, it made it to Japan. B, it's completely rented out. So
I'm impressed.
Yes, as was no. I. Flabbergasted, I more like. Yeah, I think that's because it went like straight to Sci-Fi or straight to DVD, whatever.
Or straight to Japan, apparently.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Both two and three went straight to DVD. Hmm. Actually, it's funny on the Internet Movie Database. If you go on their information, apparently even they can't be bothered with the movie because the cast that they list, like the top actor that they have billed, she's not even in the movie. I went and read like somebody's review, and he says it's actually the best of the three. You know, of course, it's not saying much. Very fair. And he goes, but nobody cares about this movie. It's like even this, she's not even in the movie.
Wow.
Ouch. So
yeah, that's pretty bad.
All right. Well, enough about Hasbro's economic model. So in our next installment of Warriors, we've decided to focus on the Mongolian Horsemen, or the Horde. So I don't know about you guys, but I remember like years ago watching either the History Channel or TLC when those
actually initials had educational programs.
Yeah, when that actually stood for the Learning Channel.
Yeah.
But I don't know what TLC stands for now. I don't know. With all the reality TV. I mean, white trash is WT, so I can't see that fitting in there. But they had thing. It was like the Golden Horde or something like that. But it was a documentary about the Golden Horde, and it was amazing. It just blew me away, and just how terrified people were of these horsemen. I really didn't know much about them at the time, so it was amazing.
I didn't have the same experience because I didn't watch the same show, but I think it's kind of telling where everybody, kind of like even to this day, like the Mongol Horde is the archetypical horde army for just about everything. You know, like fantasy races are based on the Mongol Horde. They're compared to, or not there, but like, you know, things now are compared to the Mongol hordes, and that's kind of the, I don't know, the standard for the unstoppable horde army, and for good reason.
And yet it's so poorly defined, I think, because when you think of those the great coming horde like that, you picture these kind of barbarians with low technology, you know, swinging clubs around, dressed in furs, that kind of thing. But I mean, that's not the Mongols at all.
Well,
they
no.
were first.
But, true.
They were first.
I'm sure they didn't smell very good, but still.
No, I'm thinking, you know, history is written by the victors.
Dude, they weren't that sophisticated. Don't try to play them up. And so it's like,
they weren't gentlemen, though. No.
They were on hover tanks, you know. Like, that was really underreported, you know.
I could see hover tanks and monocles drinking tea.
Seriously, they had bows. I mean, they did war for pistols. They had to recruit all of their artisans. Their entire artisan class was all foreigners.
Mm-hmm. All right. So while we're getting into the debate, how about we actually start talking about them?
All right. So like all our other Warriors episodes, we've pulled out a few things that we thought were particularly interesting about the Mongolian horsemen. And again, just the disclaimer, I mean, of course it's called Warriors, but we think these are interesting things that you can incorporate into a whole campaign or into different types of characters, your thief or your wizard. Yeah. Unfortunately, unlike other Warriors episodes, we're not going to be able to translate the key aspects into Mongolian because the Mongolian English dictionaries that we found online use Mongolian script, so we would have to be able to read the script to be able to read the Mongolian, of course.
Those of you who are looking forward to our horrible butchering of other languages, we're going to have to disappoint
yeah,
you.
Yeah, sorry. So I'm going to attempt to read this. Squiggly line, thing that looks like a Y, maybe a K. Yeah.
Oh, you forgot the dots.
Imagine an H, but with a hat. Yeah, whatever that sounds like. All right. So the first thing we have to cover because they are the Mongolian horsemen is mobility, or a Mongolian mobility.
Or in our pronunciation of the Mongol script, mobility.
We have two subtopics, and I think we're just going to be going quite fluid. The mounted archers, mm-hmm. And feigned retreat. So one of their strategies, and I think this is the kind of sophistication that, like, Chris was referring to when he was talking about clubs.
Retreat to the hover tanks.
Well, you know, actually, that's it's interesting that you pulled that up, because in more than a few places that I looked up, a lot of historians referred to them as kind of the mobilized tanks of their time, because they were so tough. There was very little that other armies could do against them. They were amazing. I think I had a quote written down here. What was it? It was.
You ever watch Remember the Titans?
No.
The movie?
Nope.
And they're like training. It's about football. Denzel Washington. It's a really good movie. And, you know, they're training. They're doing the summer training in football, mm-hmm. preseason. And he's going, hostile, agile, mobile. So it's not really the historian quote, but that's what I think of when I think of the Mongolians.
The quote was from Morris Rosavian. He called the horses... the intercontinental ballistic missiles of the 13th century.
Because they're hostile, agile, mobile. Yeah.
Because they can go to space. No. Mongols in space. Sorry, it's contractually required.
You know, they never even crossed any water. Or they crossed water once and they got defeated. How's that for an intercontinental?
Yeah, but not by the army on the other side.
No, it was just, they were amazingly fast. They were, they had really good technology in their bows and armors and, they were extremely self-sufficient. They didn't have to worry about supply lines. They were, they had advanced tactics and great communications. Then, for all that we say, you know, about them being kind of a barbaric or uncivilized group, they had an extremely high amount of organization and technology. So I was really impressed by it.
Well, I mean, not to go off on a side tangent here, but like barbaric and uncivilized doesn't mean dumb, you know, by any means. So
actually, that's a really good point.
I was going to say, I think, it's a good point. I don't know if I mean, I'm not a historian, obviously, but in addition to the being tough, I think it was also, as you said, like tactics, you know, because I've read that the Mongolian horses that they rode were smaller than European ones, and they couldn't run as fast, but the horses were armored to protect them from, you know, like return fire, and the soldiers that rode them, at least the light horse archers, were really lightly armored, even compared to other light horse archers of the time. So they certainly tried to minimize the weaknesses and play to their strengths. So it's more than just toughness, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm not saying they weren't tough, but it was more than just, you know, the brute strength kind of ride in on your horse and smash everything. It's like, no, they were really smart about setting stuff up to their advantage, mobility mm-hmm. being, you know, that giant key advantage.
I mean, people know about Attila the Hun. I mean, and he fought, like, the Romans. So, you know, fast forward, you know, centuries later, and then you have the Golden Horde sweeping down. But in that time, I mean, just because they're riding horses doesn't not mean that they're the same level of sophistication. I mean, they've had centuries to kind of refine things. And then they have, you know, new, fresh ideas in Genghis Khan. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, like you're saying, it's like, what are they? They're a mobile army. So let's not have one horse. Let's have, four or five horses
right.
for one man.
Right.
So they can always keep moving. You know, I know Chris was really impressed by their communication system using mobility. Like, I mean, we think about the Pony Express being like the first post office, and they're all on ponies.
Well, yeah.
Or horses.
I read that they established a system, like a postal relay system, that was the first empire-wide system since the Roman Empire.
It's called the Yam, yeah. Or Yam, or something.
Yeah.
See, I put your one Mongolian word. Woo!
And then, of course, there's the bow, and bows have been around for a long time, but I mean, this is a composite bow. I mean, they didn't invent it, but, I mean, it's refined, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, composite bows are actually quite difficult to make and involves several different materials, so.
Yeah, from what I was reading, it had the same range and nearly as good armor penetration as the English longbow, but could be fired from horseback.
It was also a lot smaller, too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I read that, the horse bow is one of those ancient technologies where you're like, wow, either they knew what they were doing to make those bows, or that was, you know, one of those incredibly lucky accidents. Mm-hmm. Because what I read is, like, it's one of those recurved bows. The inside was horn, which resists compression. Then there he had a layer of wood, and then the outside was sinew, which they said resists torsion. So you have a material that wants to, you know, basically spring back on the inside versus a material on the outside that wants to pull back to its shape. So that's like, instead of just being a wooden bow, that is a bunch of materials that are designed to put a lot of force behind that shot. So it's one of those things where I'm like, wow, did they actually know what they were doing? And if so, they were incredibly smart.
I think it's a combination of a couple of things, but one of them is trial and error. And we look at things, you know, I mean, it's not like one moment in time that, you know, somebody thought, okay, here, let's put all this together.
But right, like, right, exactly.
It evolves over like centuries. And that's what it is. I mean, for the mounted archer, I mean, even before Attila the Hun, there was the Romans face when they faced like the Parthians and that, they faced like mounted archers and heavily armored cavalry. Mm-hmm. But then we see that refined, you know, centuries later. And I mean, they're just at the pinnacle of what it is to be like a mounted archer.
Absolutely.
So that's amazing. Just the feigned retreat, which I think shows sophistication in tactics, is that that is just about the most difficult maneuver any army can make, either ancient or modern, is to retreat. Just a normal retreat is very difficult to do without getting your army slaughtered.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, to do a fake one, which means that not only do they have to start a retreat, but then to spring back.
Right.
Even though they're all mounted, I mean, you might think that gives them an advantage, but that just means they have to be even more coordinated. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they could do that in the heat of battle with, like, little signals from the flags and then quickly do a retreat, they go and then come back. And they weren't lucky with this tactic because they did it again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys ever played Warhammer Fantasy Battle, but the Wood Elves have... Their cavalry has that same ability, feigned retreat.
Right.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, but you never wanted to do it because it relied on, you know, the psychology test.
Oh, right, right.
And you're just like, I know I'm going to fail that. Oh, yeah. No Mongolians here. And I'm cut down.
No, but actually you said that with them using their flag system as well, that was another part of their communication that was so excellent. A lot of armies at the time, specifically European armies, they kind of relied on the single professional soldier and his retinue. So they kind of just put everybody in a force and they went out to fight for themselves, by themselves, without much direction for it. But the Mongolians, they had army-wide communication because they would try and take the high ground and signal the troop movements with flags so that they could operate as one gigantic cohesive unit. But I mean, that just kind of goes to the point that they not only were very skilled and very hardy at what they did, they were also really intelligent. Because if you look at it, the idea they were lightly armored, they rode on these smaller horses for it, and can you imagine this a Mongolian guy with light armor on a small pony going up against, you know, a full Teutonic knight on his gigantic charging warhorse? I mean, a one-on-one, it would hardly be a match at all, but they were able to dominate on the battlefield.
Specifically, well, I mean, because they didn't go one-on-one?
Yeah, exactly. They would rain arrows on those guys.
Yeah. Exactly. They fought entirely to their strengths and to their enemy's weaknesses. They fought really, really smartly.
I mean, the army was pretty much a 60-40 split between archers and lancers.
Right.
And the lancers were often just called up to mop up the fleeing troops. So,
yeah.
So it wasn't like they went one-on-one. But, I mean, that's an interesting thing to consider is that, I mean, we often think about, I mean, the cavalry, we think of the knight, so the mounted lancer. But here we have the mounted archer as well, and you think, okay, we'll put them together, and then what else could you do mounted, like, and start to build an entire party around mounted troops with slightly different strengths and weaknesses,
mm-hmm.
but working together. Now, of course, you're going to, like, do, like, a microcosm of, you know, like, an entire horde. You're not going to be playing a horde.
But, I mean, 10,000 men.
But it sinks. I mean, oftentimes when you're playing, at least in a fantasy setting, I mean, you have the one mobile guy on the horse, and nobody else really is. Everybody else just uses a horse to get from A to B.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the other person has skills and abilities related to their mount, so then it becomes very, very difficult. But, I mean, one thing about the mobility is think about planning around that mobility, whether or not you're making a biker gang, whether or not you're making, like, a jet bike gang. Wow.
Hover tanks.
Hover tank squadron. There you go.
Hover tank squadron. Each person gets their own hover tank.
No, I think that's a really good point, and it's almost kind of like the... But everybody runs into the problem of either the paladin as the one guy with that special mount, and then you go down into the dungeon and the mount's useless. Or you have the really sneaky guy, you know, the thief, who is making his sneak checks, but right behind him is, you know, everybody in plate armor. And you're like, all right, you know, it's kind of a problem. So, well,
how do they hear us?
Exactly. So you brought up, like, a really good point. Like, instead of having the one guy with... You know, who uses mounted combat like the cavalier or whatever, and having everyone else just kind of rely on mounts for transport. No, specifically build that biker gang or, you know, that cavalry squadron, and everybody has to be mounted and use that. You know, make that little microcosm of the Mongolian horse archers.
They put little, like wool booties. on the horses when they want to sneak. move silently.
Now I have like a Looney Tunes, you know, sneaking horse picture in my head, you know?
Exactly.
Up on its back legs. You know?
But, you know, I reckon the mobility aspect of it could be really well used in a game, especially if, like you said, when everybody is on their own horse, because you can really build into that fantasy trope of, you know, traversing lots of different lands, you know, going from desert to plains to Arctic to like that. Because,
and then your horse freezes.
Exactly. Falls over dead. But, I mean, the Mongolians, they did that. They went from the steppes of Asia all the way to most of the way through Europe. They covered almost every different kind of climate on Earth, I suppose, except for the Arctic one.
But, yeah, they went through the steppes of Asia to the steppes of Eurasia.
Which would include through Persia all the way up to Russia, down into China as well. Quite a few different climates.
The steppes of China.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
No, I'm just saying they actually were kind of limited by... There was a limitation to the mobility, so if you actually look and you think, wow, either the Indians were like really badass fighters in the day, or, yeah, that's not a very...
The Himalayas were a bit rough. Huh?
Yeah, it's like, we'll stop there.
One of the things I read was saying that one of the biggest limitations to the Mongolian army was grass. That's a theory as to why they didn't go further into Europe why they didn't go further into Europe is because they started hitting the forests in Europe, and there just wasn't enough grass for the horses to eat.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. When they wanted to invade Japan, they needed the Koreans to provide the navy.
Mm-hmm. That kind of gets into mobility again because, yeah, okay, they were limited to certain types of terrain, whether it was because they couldn't feed their horses enough to progress farther or because the terrain wasn't conducive to cavalry attacks. So they were really careful in picking where they fought. And because they were a mobile force, they were able to do that much more easily than their opponents were. You know, absolutely. They determined when and where they fought, making sure they had the advantage.
So they would surround the dungeon and starve out all the monsters in there. We'll wait. Surrender. Imagine if they were on griffins. Wow. They would have been unstoppable.
That's what the Mongolian Empire was lacking. That's why they failed. Their lack of griffins.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we talk about like a microcosm, and you're also talking about how, you know, sophisticated the communication was. I mean, that gets into our next point of what we call the decimal system, where they kind of divided things in groups of 10. Like 10 would be Arban.
But 100 would be Zoot.
Yeah. And probably the more famous is 10,000, which is the Tumen. So that's, yeah, I mean, it just like whether you can scale up and scale down, which I think is really helpful for a game.
And one of the advantages of this smaller 10-man squadron is that they were able to divide up responsibility and duties.
Yeah, like weren't they one of the first sort of ancient armies to give their officers a lot of flexibility in meeting goals so long as they... you know, met that larger goal for the army as a whole?
I think so. I was a little unclear on it, though, because there's a lot talking about how absolute loyalty was an important aspect of it, but also how they were allowed quite a bit of freedom in carrying out the missions. So.
Well, those things aren't mutually exclusive, you know? Like, you can be absolutely loyal, but, you know, flexible. And, yeah, if they weren't the first, they were one of the first, you know? And that's why they were so successful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's also why, I guess, getting back to maybe an earlier point of why they were able to pull off feigned retreats or pull off some of those difficult tactical maneuvers, because they had absolute loyalty, you know?
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the things that I read was saying that one of the reasons for the Mongol success is the absolute loyalty is that they were, you know, so vicious, and a lot of problems with raiding armies and nomadic armies, that when they would attack a settlement, then the army would break up halfway through the attack because a lot of the troops would go off and just start their plunder midway through the battle. But Genghis Khan started out to where if you plunder before the battle's over, before everyone else is dead or routed, then you will also die. And so that absolute loyalty was very important to maintaining the horde.
Well, in addition to that, like, one of the things I read is that when Genghis Khan was setting up the army, he was uniting all these fractious tribes, and he very smartly broke them all up among those, the different groups of 10, you know, so that they're... You didn't have units comprised of a single tribe.
Yes,
they were all spread out over, you know, the entirety of the army, so that the people were loyal to him and the army as a whole, as opposed to just their unit.
Mm-hmm. Well, except for the tribes that were loyal to him.
Yeah. Like, he did kind of play favorites, but... I think that's another reason why they were so successful, and that's also really smart because, you know...
It ended the blood feuds among the tribes that have been going on for centuries.
I mean,
But you see that referenced in a lot of... in the stories when they do talk about the hordes, because it's like, wow, you know... I mean, they were always there ready to just wash over civilization.
Right.
But this one warlord was able to unite all the tribes, or, you know, even the orcs kind of follow that, you know, one warlord? War boss?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
War boss, yeah. That's
it. Oh, you're talking the 40K when they formed up the big WOG, you know?
Yeah, the WOG. Yeah, one guy's able to do it. Yeah, so, I mean, that comes from Genghis Khan, and, you know, by breaking up those tribal identities. Mm-hmm. And just to get in, just to kind of go back to the decimal system, the scalability of kind of playing that, I mean, then it allows you to have, like, a variety of different, you know, ethnic groups working together, and that's the reason for it. It's like, you guys are broken up, and you can have those, like, old rivalries. I mean, it doesn't mean you forget.
Right.
But it can add some nice tension to the group. You know, it's like, well, we hate each other. You know, we have a blood pact or a blood feud against each other. But we're put together, and loyalty to the horde over loyalty to the old family. But still some tension, you know, between the players.
Yeah, I was going to bring it up later on when we were talking about assimilation, but I think that's a really good thing you could bring into the game, is that it's forced variety. Everyone has to be some kind of a different character from a different background or a different tribe or something like that. So it's nice that you kind of have to build in a melting pot. And another aspect to it is that they weren't allowed to transfer out of their units. They had to stay together through thick and thin. So your party can't break up.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great thing for a GM to use for why groups are together. Great. Mm-hmm. Make whoever you want. Great. Okay. And now you're all in this unit together.
Yep. And you were conquered. Let's see. You were slaughtered. You've joined voluntarily.
Exactly. Like, and I also read that, you know, if people, as you said, Chris, either started looting and plundering before the conquering was finished, or if they, like, attempted to desert, or if they were caught fleeing, then not only them, but the 9 other guys in their decimal were also executed. That's a real powerful motivator to, hey, don't mess up. Mm-hmm. You know, you better follow orders. So, as you said, Lyle, that while there will still be that rivalry between players, possibly, or between characters, it'll never really spill over to armed conflict or violent conflict, you know? Because, hey, I don't want to die, you know? Because I killed this guy or I did something stupid. So maybe it'll just be, you know, I'll salt his meat a little bit too much. But that'll be the end of it, you know?
Unless you got a real douche in the group, because then he'll just get everybody killed.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and we're going to start again. And, yep, you're in the decimal again.
But, I mean, Chris mentioned it, but yeah, our next point is assimilation, which this is leading into, in that one of the things the Mongols did was, I mean, they would increase their horde by, you know, recruiting soldiers, artisans, and support units, you know, from the conquered territories.
Mm-hmm.
So if they surrendered, then they had a chance to join the Mongol horde. Maybe not really a chance, but kind of forced exactly. into it.
Yeah, yeah.
An opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah, it was either live and join us, or don't and we'll eradicate you.
Well, even they didn't even offer him that choice. There was either live and service as a slave, or we'll kill you like that. And the only way you could get out of that is if when they first showed up, you kind of raise your hand. Oh, I'll join you right now.
Maybe they're jumping ahead, but like once you start a war with them, all right, yeah. Never mind then.
Yeah,
do you well then that? Continue with assimilation by all means.
But you know, I thought you mentioned before about how they had to import all of their artisans, but I was actually kind of impressed by that because I mean, at least they appreciated music somewhat that they kept those people alive.
No, I didn't necessarily say artists.
He's an artisan.
As okay. did I. But that
you,
includes musicians as well.
You, what do you do? I play the lute. You, what do you do? I can build siege engines. Guess who they're going to take?
Both of them.
Oh, please. Smart guy.
1 point.
They would also actually take the philosophers and the doctors and that.
Yeah.
So, that's great. I mean, it allows you to have like a really diverse party and like what Wayne was saying. Hey, make whatever. Okay, and I think that can cause some suspension of disbelief. You know, a little chafing at the beginning of the game before players really get used. Yeah, get used to it. It's like, oh, what's my dwarf doing with this elf? You know, we hate each other.
Mm-hmm. But it's good. Like, follow the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It might be a little cliched, but you could start it off, you know, with everyone in chains. You know, welcome to the Mongol horde. You will build siege engines for us, or I suppose you will work your magics for us, or you will die.
No, that's good. I mean, you put them in that 10-man unit, and I think the decimal system was more for the warriors, but you can play with that and say it's just for actually like a self-contained unit of, you know, all these different skills and trades.
Yeah, you can do 4 or 6 depending on your group size. You don't have to find 10 players.
No, but I was also saying it's like it doesn't have to be like 10 cavalry guys
right. With
a support staff of, you know, 3 wizards. It can be like, yeah, 4 guys, but I mean, that's what it was. It's like we've scaled you down to the smallest unit. And, hey, what's this orc doing here? Hey, whatever. Hmm. He was conquered just like you were. And that can actually form a bond. It's like, whatever your backstory is. Oh, and by the way, you were just conquered by the Golden Horde. Oh, okay, yep. Great.
Great.
Good to know. Me being a prince, gotta cross that off.
Yeah. Can we, like, play a prequel game where we actually, you know, kind of try to resist them first? No.
Can I do something with these points? Nope. All right.
Yeah, I wrote in my background that my family died. Oh, everybody's family died.
Oh, it's not special. All right.
Well, isn't that kind of how you would be? Yeah, that's right. In the Golden Horde, you're not special. You're just like everybody else.
No, he only wrote down his brother died, and everybody's like, well, my whole family got massacred. Yeah. Great.
Exactly.
Now I just seem moody. But I mean, that's pretty dynamic. Imagine, like, you know, I'm not a massive fan of Firefly, but I did like what they did with the Reavers.
Right.
And you make those, like, the Golden Horde. Well, except the Reavers ate everybody.
Except okay. They're not crazy. Wearing
not,
skins.
Not a perfect analogy, but follow me if you But, you know, the massive hordes of ships that float, and then suddenly they capture you, bam, you're in this ship. And you're part of the horde. Okay, you can now peel off and do this adventure. But you're, like, with all these, like, aliens from other planets, you know. And you were actually at war with this other group until the horde swept through while you guys were at war and conquered you both. And now you're like, all right, we're together now.
Right. I could see that as being pretty fun and interesting so long as the GM kind of put some kind of supervisor above them. My feeling is there would have to be something preventing the players from just, as you said, like, peeling off to do their own thing and then never going back to the horde, you know?
Well, it could be a couple things. I mean, it could be, the supervisor. It could be the bomb
Bomb collars.
Bomb necklace.
Yeah.
Oh, the bomb collar. Jeez, I couldn't remember. I was going bomb necklace. Bomb amulet.
Anklets,
bomb collar.
Anklets.
Yeah.
Earrings.
Ah, I lost my foot, but I have my freedom. Oh.
You know what I was thinking? The campaign that I wanted to run with this is...
Oh, sorry, but I actually had a finish to that. Is that it could be just, you know, kind of the threat, like, well, yeah, you could take off in that ship and go maybe be free for 2 years, but you'll always be looking over your shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'll get you, because that's what they do. You know, it's just like, all right, we'll peel off 3 of our loyal ships to hunt them down and kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And that could actually be a really exciting part of the game, and that's where the players can actually interject, because the game master might not actually plan for that. He's like, okay, do this mission, and they're like, no, we're going to now go peel off, and then the game master's like, all right, well, let's play this. Let's roll with this.
Yeah.
This is going to be fun. By the way, you're going to be hunted down.
Yeah, yeah. I
and,
you know,
and really play that and do it where you guys could all die. Not like you're going to be hunted down, but you're going to do a heroic stand and you'll all survive. No, it could be, well, all right, guys, let's see the consequences.
You're going to die, but it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
That leads into a bridge point, which is going to bridge us into psychological warfare. But that is a concept called Karash. Does that sound right, guys? Karash?
Sure.
Yeah. And that's the idea of, like, it's a step down, admittedly, from being a slave. And that's being a human shield. Or being the suicide first guys that go up the wall, or guys that charge in to soak up their arrows, you know.
I think the important part here is not by choice.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you won't live. You won't survive. Yeah, and those are the guys that did fight back, and they might have think, okay, but we're going to do a major battle soon. So, yeah, you'll live for a little bit, and then we're going to, you know, use you in a certain way.
Yeah. It was amazing how they used them. I was reading some of the some examples of it. There was one siege in a Russian city called Vladimir, and they used the, I think they called them levies in this. I don't know if that was a Mongolian term or another term, but I hadn't heard it before. But they took the levies, marched them up to this city, Vladimir, which had these really high walls and good fortifications. So they had the levies actually build an outer wall around it, like an encapsulating fort, and then go in and build ballistas, and then go in after that and fill in the moat. Although, the whole while, the Mongolians were just kind of sitting back and watching while these guys just got slaughtered by their own countrymen as they were building up the city. And yeah, eventually when the ballistas broke through the wall, then the Mongolians ran in and killed everybody.
Hmm. Yeah, no, it's Levy's like a recruit.
Okay.
Yeah, but I guess the Mongols give it that darker flavor. Yeah. There.
So that's the end to your campaign if you do decide to break off and do your own thing.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, you will live as a Levy. Yeah. Oh, ouch. Actually, for the Mongolians, it's a Karash.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it reminds me of, you know, in the Road Warrior, when they drive up with the two people strapped to the front of the car.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're like, well, you know, they're gonna they have arrows and that, so let's strap some people in front of our cars and drive up.
Yeah. And it's worse too, because they usually take those people from around the area where we're attacking, so you know, you're shooting at people that you might even know.
Oh, and that's what happened in the Road Warrior, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. So you're saying the Great Humongous was an apocalyptic Mongolian?
In many respects, yeah. I mean, he was intelligent. I mean, he had a hoard for a low-budget Australian film, you know. Yeah, and I mean, that leads into our next point, which is, it is psychological warfare, or you can even expand that into total warfare. And yeah, one of the things, yeah, I mean, if you're seeing your own countrymen being used as a human shield, or they're the ones battering down your walls, I mean, it kind of kills you a little bit each time, you know. Cutting them down, and you just know that they're soaking up arrows that would be better used against the Mongols.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that kind of like terror tactic is amazing. I mean, people were just terrified of them.
Yeah, and you know, you don't want to waste those arrows, or you don't want to save those arrows on your own countrymen, because you know that if you don't fend off the Mongols, they're going to kill you all. I mean, they have this. This air about them. Everyone knows the Mongols, that they slaughter any city that tries to fight back. And that's part of it. That's part of the psychological warfare.
Yeah, like when I started doing research for this, I kind of thought, okay, the psychological warfare is just the idea that, yeah, they slaughter anyone who doesn't submit to them. And I kind of thought that that's all it was. But again, being a barbarian or being a horde doesn't mean you're not intelligent, because they would intentionally let people escape so that they could, you know, flee and then spread news about what a terrible massacre they had just lived through and what was coming for the people who didn't submit. Mm-hmm. And that, I thought that was horrible, but also incredibly intelligent, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I was just kind of like flabbergasted by that. And the other stuff they did, like we've mentioned that being horse archers and be, you know, having all this mobility, the warriors had 3 or 4 or even 5 horses per person. So one of the things I read that they did is they would tie like tree branches behind their horses to kick up a giant dust storm behind them and obscure their numbers. You know, so you couldn't see how many were coming. And we, again, with their multiple horses and their taking of slaves to be used as a human meat shield, they would also put slaves and conquered peoples on horses for at least a short time to, again, make it look like there were a lot more of them coming down on the enemy. Mm-hmm. You know, and so people in this town, this city, you know, they say, wow, look at all those horses, and every single one of them has a person on it. And that's a lot of guys we're going to have to deal with. How about we just surrender?
Yeah. Same thing at night. They would light up to 5 fires per person, so they would just look like there's more and more of them encamped out waiting to come and get you.
Yeah.
And actually, as Lyle mentioned before, the feigned retreat, I mean, that's as much a psychological aspect as it is a strategic one.
Yeah. You think about it like, all right, yeah, we got them on the run, we're winning. And then you're like, holy crap, where did everybody just go? You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. In addition to feigned retreat, they'd also, the Mongols would also set up, they'd like split their army into multiple parts, and then they would carefully position each part so that it seemed like, you know, that like whole armies would just appear from nowhere, mm-hmm. when like other parts of the army would like approach from the flank or the rear, because, mm-hmm. you know, the enemy thought, okay, you know, we're fighting the entirety of the army, and it's like, nope, and now guys are coming up from the left, the right, or behind you. And mm-hmm. apparently they were so skilled at it, it would just appear as if the Mongolian horsemen were appearing out of nowhere.
Yeah, they were. You mentioned before about how they only fought on when and where they wanted to, and that, yeah, they used ambushes a lot for that. And they used the smoke screens as well, so that when they were doing this fake retreat, they would kick up the dust so that people couldn't see the flanking Mongolians coming up on them. So I guess it just kind of goes to show, you know, they were strong, they were tough, but as I said before, you know, they were really, really smart. And that's something you can definitely bring into a game, is that it's not enough to just try and slam down the enemy, but you really have to outthink them as well. You know, it takes strategy.
Can I mean, one thing that I think might be fun to play with, but a little dark, is the more gruesome aspects of their psychological warfare, like when they, you know, catapulted bodies and heads into cities. And I'm not necessarily saying that you have to do that in the game, but I mean, we're talking about playing these not necessarily as antagonists, but protagonists in your story.
Right.
And even if you are, I mean, going back to the assimilation, you're from a good nation, if you will, and you're part of this horde, but you still got to play ball with them, and you got to succeed in this horde. So I guess it could allow your players to get a little creative on the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
And still be the hero?
Well, yeah, there's that part of it. And also, it's kind of the moral choice, you know? You if you want to play the protagonist and you want to play them as a hero, how do you deal with being stuck in this situation where you have to do these, well, I suppose, what you would consider reprehensible actions? You know, we also talked about the Karashes as well. I think about if you've just been captured, you know, maybe you're the magician or the engineer, so you're being forced to build the machines that are going to destroy your city. You know, you get to watch people that you knew from your same town being, you know, dashed up against these walls and killed by other people that you know. It could be a really dramatic part of a story for some players. Though, again, it could be too dark for others.
That'd be a pretty nasty move for a GM. He'd be like, okay, and yeah, where are you from? Yeah, okay, okay, nice backstory, yeah. You're all part of the Horde, and your first mission is build siege towers to knock that place down. There you go.
I don't really recommend it pulling it as a surprise choice like that, but it might be something that players would be interested in exploring. Again, if they like kind of the deeper, darker aspects of stories.
We keep defaulting to the Horde being NPCs. I think maybe that's why we don't see like Mongolian heroes in stories. You know, maybe in Mongolia they probably do, but
right,
yeah.
But it's almost like some sort of genetic history that we have where we always just view them as the other.
Right. Well, that's kind of what I was going to bring up in like way in the beginning is, you know, history is written by the victors and, you know, the empire did eventually dissolve and they did invade a lot of people, you know, a lot of different people. So I'm sure there's a lot of cultural histories where the Horde, as you said, Lyle, is the other and is evil. So.
Yeah. But even as we're talking about trying to play them, we keep going, or you could be these prisoners. These good guys.
Well, I guess yeah. One way to spin it is you're imposing. It's kind of hard because we generally like freedom, you know, at least being Westerns and stuff. But you, as part of the Mongolian Horde, or as part of the, you know, Horde, you are imposing order on the rest of the world. And, you know, whether it's by divine right or just because you are the strongest or whatever reason, the other people of the world that you're conquering don't deserve to rule themselves. So it's not so much evil, it's arrogant. And that also is kind of hard for us to stomach. And another reason why the Horde is probably seen as evil.
I'm going to disagree.
Okay.
Because the Romans did the same thing. And the Romans did gruesome things. Like, if you look at Julius Caesar wiped out tribes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think, yeah, no, just that there's something about the Mongolians, and I don't want to make too much of it, but it could be because they're not from Europe.
Right.
You know, they're from outside of Europe, and we're so used to history coming from Europe that we can kind of identify. And maybe, of course, in Mongolia, they are the heroes, just like Vlad Tepes is a hero in Romania. And everybody else has trouble, like, reconciling the fact that he impaled people and killed a lot of his own people. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, you said it before, Lyle, that that kind of bloody history, that was intentional on their part.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I read one story. I forget the name of the city, but the city revolted against Genghis Khan. So he went back and he went to slaughter every single person in the city. And he said because he doesn't want them to ever forget anyone anywhere in the world to ever forget that if you go against the Mongols, this is what happens to you. And I think he was talking to one of the leaders of the city after he'd killed pretty much everybody else for it. And he said, do you think now that people will remember this slaughter? And he says to Genghis Khan, I don't think there will eventually be enough people left to remember the slaughter when you're done.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cold.
But again, the Romans did the same thing.
That's true,
they took slaves.
But the Romans didn't intentionally try and spread this as the world. They went out.
No, they did.
They did?
Yeah, sometimes it would backfire. Mm-hmm. The terror tactic would backfire, and sometimes it would work. Mm. It's not like the Mongols invented these tactics. It was just that they did them so well. And around that time, I do think you guys are hitting upon it where it's like, you know, people who are writing the history. And at the time, a lot of the stuff that was getting passed down to us now was being written at that particular time. What was that? Around like a little after the millennium.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that we kind of carry that with us where, I mean, Romans also have a lot of other things. I mean,
right.
I guess positive baggage, if you will. And we just don't associate any positive baggage, even though we've just talked about all the, you know,
terrible things they do.
Well, also the communication system, which is really great, and things like that.
A lot of the
and
technological prowess.
They didn't discriminate against religion, and
mm-hmm. I mean,
they didn't have any religious wars.
Yeah, they're one of the most egalitarian societies in the ancient world.
Yeah. You can't help but wonder if, I mean, not help but wonder, I'm sure we would be seeing things in a different light if the Mongolian Empire had expanded into Europe.
Yeah, and once they settle down, and of course they've just rounded up all the writers, and the writer's going to be writing what's, you know, history that is semi-accurate, but very favorable to the Mongolians.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But then you get that in Mongolia now. Genghis Khan is a national hero. Though I've not been there myself, I've heard that it's not a good idea to go around in Mongolia and insult Genghis Khan because people will beat you up for it.
Oh, gee. Why would you do that? That's like saying, hey, you know what? Don't go to America as a foreigner and say bad things about the president. Hey, don't.
I think you could get away with saying some bad things about the president of the States.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that called the Republican Party? Yeah.
No, I meant as someone who is not from America.
No, but I was just thinking, like, why would anybody insult Genghis Khan? Because so long ago?
I don't think it's a specific reason that you go there to specifically to, you know, insult Genghis Khan.
It's like people in Japan over drinks. It's like,
just to say that he's, even though he's an ancient figure, he is still so highly revered that people should take it as a personal insult if you insulted him. So I've heard.
He also probably had a lot of grandkids.
Yeah, yeah. Up to 10 million people in China are conceivably his progeny.
Wow. Busy man. Where did he find the time? there's something I don't want to like trivialize the Mongolian horde, but if you read about the BattleTech clans, that's interesting, especially when they take on bondsmen or like Inner Sphere bondsmen and people who don't know BattleTech Inner Sphere, kind of like us in space,
right?
Except with giant mechs or battle mechs, mm-hmm. And the clans were us. But then they formed like a warrior society and all the positive and negatives that entails. So they have a very ritualized combat, but then they also would take a person and they're pretty much a slave, but they have the chance to earn to be a warrior in that clan, which is a high honor.
Mm-hmm.
And they call them clans and the leaders of each clan is called a Khan. Wow. So, I mean, even taking that from the Mongolians. So first they sweep down like a horde, like they don't even know if they're human. They think they might even be their first encounter with an alien race. And they sweep in, and they're terrified, and people are attributing all these atrocities. And they could be ruthless, where, like, you know, a planet resists, so they just, you know, from the battleships in space, they, like, bombard the city and destroy it and just wipe it off. You know, like, there's a lesson for you. It's gone. Do you want us to do that to the other cities? So people are like, wow, they're so ruthless. But then as you get to know them, it's like, well, they are a lot like us and, oh, there's a lot of honor in this system. And there is a method to this madness. So, and I mean, that can be a way to, I'm not saying you have to go out and read BattleTech, although I encourage you to read it anyway, but that can kind of help you if you still see the Horde as the other and you want to incorporate them into the game. It's like, yeah, have some of the players play them and other players maybe play other races. Cause I just think that's just kind of exciting playing that really mixed group. But yeah, they've got to slowly kind of adapt and they can't always resist this culture. They just try to have to understand it. And if, you know, when they're lobbing like heads into the city, you know, or whatever, whatever version you're going to do in your game, there's actually a reason is so they don't have to keep killing people in different cities.
Well, that didn't really come up until now, but I read that the Mongolian horde would actually prefer countries to submit or nations to submit because that's how they fed their army. That's how they got a lot of supplies. And, you know, having them or having an enemy submit gave them more resources rather than them having to burn it to the ground.
And they also didn't want it. They didn't want to farm those fields.
Yeah.
They wanted farmers to do it. I mean, Korea just gave them all this tribute.
Mm-hmm.
And Korea's terrain's not terribly favorable to the Horde, but they're close enough. They're not, like, separated by water like Japan was. So they're like, all right, well, just give us some tribute and we'll leave you alone. Yeah, and they actually left them fairly independent.
And again, I think that's another really kind of important point if you're going to do something like a Mongolian Horde in your game is if someone submitted, they got left alone. Apart from the tribute they had to put, you know, or give the Horde. But if someone fought, then it's like, okay, they got eradicated. Specifically so that was a lesson to other people. It's like, hey, it's going to be a lot easier if you submit.
And, you know, the Mongolians' trade flourished under Mongolian rule. The old Silk Road had kind of fallen apart. It was in disrepair for when around this time in history. But when the Mongolians did it again, like, trade flourished because they kept the place really safe. There weren't many brigands. An old saying during the Middle Ages that you could walk from one end of the Mongol Empire to the other with a golden plate on your head and not be robbed.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, and I just, like, build up a slightly foreign, but, I mean, you can make it a very much a warrior culture. But they have rules, and it's not about, you know, protect the weak and that. But, I mean, it has a rationale to it. They don't just kill just for the sake of killing.
Hmm.
And, you know, as you're, like, you know, making that spell to, you know, bring down the walls, I mean, if you play it right, you are, like, silently praying, please surrender to the people inside.
Hmm.
You know, because you're starting to kind of come over to the Mongolian horde and way of thinking. And if you are, like, playing a hordesman, you're, like, thinking, it's like, oh, no, you'll learn, you know, just, you know, it that was tough. I mean, you can understand, you know, you didn't want to kill your whole family and all your relatives. I understand that was a hard thing to do. But I think, you're becoming more of a warrior, or you're becoming one of us. And, you know, this is a good way to live and that.
We're bringing you into a better culture. We win all the wars we fight.
Yeah.
Why would you not want to be part of us?
Yeah, and you can say, well, you don't really have a culture. And you go, no, this is the culture.
Mm-hmm.
They were saying about the German general staff after World War II, some of the Allies had trouble talking to them about right and wrong, because they thought, you know, when they would talk to them, it's like, well, do you think it was wrong that you, like, for example, invaded Russia? And they would say, yeah, that was wrong, because that was, you know, we were never going to be able to beat Russia.
Mm.
You know, but they always related it back to, you know, winning and losing.
Right.
And it was like, wrong was like, we lost, or we knew we were going to lose. And a lot of German general staff didn't think it was feasible to invade Russia, or to beat Russia, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So that, but it wasn't like, well, it was wrong because we broke a treaty and, well, we actually killed a lot of people and we enslaved people. But it was like, no, like, yeah, no, we lost. I mean, obviously, yeah, it was the wrong thing to do. We lost.
Yeah.
Declaring war on the U.S. was wrong because you guys came over and we lost.
Yeah, it was very Machiavellian. And the Mongolian culture too was also very Machiavellian. If you succeeded, then it was the right thing to do. How you got there wasn't necessarily as important, or as important at all. That's a speculation on my part, but I suppose that's probably what drove the merit system that Genghis Khan had.
I honestly thought you were going to say World of Darkness. I was like, whoa, Whiplash.
Merit system. Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Hey-o.
I didn't get it.
No. I mean, just to follow up on what Chris was really saying. Yeah, it was, yeah, a meritocracy in many respects. I mean, if you were Genghis Khan's blood, maybe not one of the 10 million, but one that had like a lot of it, then yeah, sure, you were going to rise up. But other than that, a lot of people would rise up just based on their own ability and not necessarily, you know, who their father was or who their mother was. I mean, that's admirable.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, on that depressing note, the Mongolian horsemen, we were pretty excited to talk about them for obvious reasons. And I think you can play like a very, very different type of game. It can be a much darker type of game than you think, if you really want to get the full flavor, in our opinion. But also, you could have one of the most diverse parties, be it a World of Darkness kind of crazy Mongolian version of that, or science fiction, or definitely fantasy. I mean, there you have the instant justification for having as many different types of characters having to work together, whether they want to or not.
So they have to. And now you put the image in my head of a Mongolian horseman horde based up of mages, werewolves, changelings,
yeah,
ghosts,
to picture that myself.
Prometheans. There you go, because you said World of Darkness. I'm like, all the splat books together as a unit.
One confusing campaign.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just, yeah, but for whatever reason, they just start taking whatever they're doing. I mean, some huge shadow war with a shadow horde. I always forget the stuff in Changeling, but who's on the other side of the hedge?
The true fae.
The true fae?
Yep. It would have to be some kind of like shadowy thing, you know, some shadowy entity that blotted out the sun. Otherwise, vampires wouldn't be able to participate.
Well, half the time.
All right, I thought that was funny. All right. Joke fail yet again.
They can't if they have enclosed cars or hover tanks. And that, there we bring it full circle. All right. Well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episodes right there on the website or stream them through iTunes or Stitcher, or you can download them off of DriveThruRPG. You can contact us by following us on Facebook and posting there, or through Twitter, or by sending us an email or commenting on the episodes themselves, because we always love hearing from all of you. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
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 DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.